Well, I'm going to do something a little bit different tonight. Something I've been wanting to do for quite some time. Discussed it with the elders, and they thought that it would be a good idea, or they would at least go along with it. And instead of a lesson tonight, I'm going to read you a book, or a part of a book, that is has been particularly meaningful to me in my life. It's really a peculiar little book. It's entitled A Tale of Three Kings. And it is written in view of people who have suffered difficulty and heartache, things like church splits, things like where they have been in stressful situations within the church and had people with whom they've had serious disagreement, were unable to work them out. I have personally read this book, I don't know how many times, a bunch of times, and I go back and read it over and over again. And the reading will actually take two Sunday nights. Tonight, I hope to be able to get the first parts a little bit longer than the latter part, and so it'll take a little bit longer tonight than it will, Lord willing, next Sunday night. So I hope if you'll just sit back and relax, then I'm going to sit down myself. And by the way, if I hadn't told you teens, I really do appreciate you sitting right there in the same spot down front here. So just get you a good deep seat, and I'm going to read to you tonight. Thank you for meeting here. I suggest we hasten into the playhouse. As I see, they've already dimmed the lights. There are two seats reserved for us, not too far from the stage. Quickly, let's take them. I understand the story is a drama. I trust, though, you'll not find it sad. I believe we'll find the story to be in two parts. In part one, we'll meet an older king, Saul by name, and a young shepherd boy named David. In part two, we shall once more meet an older king and a young man, but this time the older king is David and the young man is Absalom. The story is a portrait. You might prefer to call it a rough charcoal sketch of submission and authority within the kingdom of God. They've turned off the lights. The players have taken their places. The audience has quieted itself. The curtain is rising. Our story has begun. The Almighty Living God turned to Gabriel and gave him a command. Go take these two portions of my being, their two destinies waiting. To each unborn destiny give one portion of myself. Carrying two glowing, pulsating lights of life, Gabriel opened the door into the realm between two universes and disappeared. He had stepped into the maw of unborn destinies. Gabriel spoke, I have here two portions of the nature of God. The first is the very cloth of his nature. When wrapped about you, it clothes you with the breath of God. As water surrounds a person in the sea, so will his very breath envelop you. With this, the divine breath, you will have his power, power to subdue armies, shame the enemies of God, and accomplish his work on earth. Here is the power of God as a gift. Here is immersion into the Spirit, a destiny step forward. This portion of God is for me. True, replied the angel. And remember, whoever receives such a great portion of power will surely be known by many. Ere your earthly pilgrimage is done, your true character will be known. Yea, it will be revealed by means of this power. Such is the destiny of all who want and wield this portion. For it touches only the outer person, affecting the inner person not one whit. Outer power will always unveil the inner resources or the lack thereof. The first destined one received the gift and stepped back. Gabriel spoke again. I have here the second of two elements of the living God. It is not a gift, but an inheritance. A gift is worn on the outer person. An inheritance is planted deep inside, like a seed. Yet even though it's such a small planting, this planting grows and in time fills all the inner person. Another destiny step forward. I believe this element is to be mine for my earthly pilgrimage. True, responded the angel again. I must tell you that what has been given to you is a glorious thing, the only element in the universe that can change the human heart. Yet even this element of God cannot accomplish its task, nor grow and fill your entire inner being unless it's compounded well. It must be mixed lavishly with pain, sorrow, and crushing. The second destined one received the inheritance and stepped back. Beside Gabriel sat the angel recorder. He dutifully entered into his ledger the record of the two destinies. And who shall these two destinies become after they go through the door into the visible universe? Asked recorder. Gabriel replied softly, each in his time shall be king. Part 1. The youngest son of any family bears two distinctions. He's considered to be both spoiled and uninformed. Usually, little is expected of him. Inevitably, he displays fewer characteristics of leadership than the other children in the family. As a child, he never leads, he only follows, for he has no one younger on whom to practice leadership. So it is today, and so it was 3,000 years ago in a village called Bethlehem in a family of 8 boys. The first 7 sons of Jesse worked near their father's farm. The youngest was sent on treks into the mountains to graze the family's small flock of sheep. On those pastoral jaunts, this youngest son always carried 2 things, a sling and a small guitar-like instrument. Spare time for a sheep herder is abundant on rich mountain plateaus where sheep can graze for days in one sequestered meadow. But as time passed and days became weeks, the young man became very lonely. The feeling of friendlessness that always roamed inside him was magnified. He often cried. He also played his harp a great deal. He had a good voice, so he sang often. When these activities failed to comfort him, he gathered up a pile of stones and one by one swung them at a distant tree with something akin to fury. When one rock pile was depleted, he would walk to the blistered tree, reassemble his rocks, and designate another leafy enemy at yet a further distance. He engaged in many such solitary battles. This shepherd, singer, slinger also loved his Lord. At night, when all the sheep lay sleeping and he sat staring into the dying fire, he would strum upon his harp and break into a quiet song. He sang the ancient hymns of his forefathers' faith. While he sang, he wept, and while weeping, he often broke out into abandoned praise, until the mountains and the distant places lifted up his praise and tears and passed them on to higher mountains, until they eventually reached the ears of God. When the young shepherd did not praise and when he did not cry, he tended to each and every sheep and lamb. When not occupied with his flock, he swung his companionable sling and swung it again and again until he could tell every rock precisely where to go. Once, while singing his lungs out to God, angels, sheep, and passing clouds, he spied a living enemy, a huge bear. He lunged forward. Both found themselves moving furiously toward the same small object, a lamb feeding at the table of rich green grass. Youth and bear stopped halfway and whirled to face one another. Even as he instinctively reached into his pocket for a stone, the young man realized, why, I'm not afraid. Meanwhile, brown lightning on mighty furry legs charged at the shepherd with foaming madness. Impelled by the strength of youth, the young man married rock to leather, and soon a brook-smooth pebble whined through the air to meet that charge. A few moments later, the man, not quite so young as moments before, picked up the little lamb and said, I am your shepherd, and God is mine. And so, long into the night, he wove the day's saga into a song. He hurled that hymn to the skies again and again until he had taught the melody and words to every angel that had ears. They, in turn, became custodians of this wondrous song and passed it on as healing balm to brokenhearted men and women in every age to come. Chapter 2. A figure in the distance was running toward him. It grew and became his brother. "Run," cried the brother. "Run with all your strength. I'll watch the flock." "Why?" "An old man, a sage. He wants to meet all 8 of the sons of Jesse, and he's seen all but you." "But why?" "Run." So David ran. He stopped long enough to get his breath. Then, sweat pouring down his sunburned cheeks, his red face matching his red curly hair, he walked into his father's house, his eyes recording everything in sight. The youngest son of Jesse stood there, tall and strong, but more in the eyes of the curious old gentleman than to anyone else in the room. Kith and kin cannot always tell when a man is grown, even when looking straight at him. The elderly man saw, and something more he saw, in a way he himself did not understand. The old man knew what God knew. God had taken a house-to-house survey of the whole kingdom in search of someone very special. As a result of this survey, the Lord God Almighty had found that this leather-lunged troubadour loved his Lord with a purer heart than anyone else on all the sacred soil of Israel. "Kneel," said the bearded one with the long gray hair, almost regally for one who had never been in that particular position. David knelt and then felt oil pouring down on his head. Somewhere in one of the closets of his mind, labeled childhood information, he found a thought. This is what men do to designate royalty. Samuel is making me a what? The Hebrew words were unmistakable. Even children knew them. Behold the Lord's anointed. Quite a day for that young man, wouldn't you say? Then do you find it strange that this remarkable event led the young man not to the throne, but to a decade of hellish agony and suffering? On that day, David was enrolled not into the lineage of royalty, but into the school of brokenness. Samuel went home. The sons of Jesse, save one, went forth to war. And the youngest, not yet ripe for war, received a promotion in his father's home, from sheepherder to messenger boy. His new job was to run food and messages to his brothers on the front lines. He did this regularly. On one such visit to the battlefront, he killed another bear, in exactly the same way as he had the first. This bear, however, was 9 feet tall and bore the name Goliath. As a result of this unusual feat, young David found himself a folk hero and eventually found himself in the palace of a mad king. And in circumstances that were as insane as the king, the young man was to learn many indispensable lessons. Chapter 3. David sang to the mad king often. The music helped the old man a great deal, it seemed. And all over the palace, when David sang, everyone stopped in the corridors, turned their ears in the direction of the king's chamber, and listened and wondered, how did such a young man come to possess such wonderful words and music? Everyone's favorite seemed to be the song the little lamb had taught him. They loved that song as much as did the angels. Nonetheless, the king was mad, and therefore he was jealous. Or was it the other way around? Either way, Saul felt threatened by David, as kings often do when there's a popular, promising young man beneath them. The king also knew, as did David, that this boy just might have his job someday. But would David ascend to the throne by fair means or foul? Saul did not know. This question is one of the things that drove the king mad. David was caught in a very uncomfortable position. However, he seemed to grasp a deep understanding of the unfolding drama in which he had been caught. He seemed to understand something that few even of the wisest men of his day understood. Something that in our day, when men are wiser still, even fewer understand. And what was that? God did not have, but wanted very much to have, men and women who would live in pain. God wanted a broken vessel. Chapter 4. The mad king saw David as a threat to the king's kingdom. Saul did not understand, it seems, that God should be left to decide what kingdom survived which threats. Not knowing this, Saul did what all mad kings do. He threw spears at David. He could. He was king. Kings can do things like that. They almost always do. Kings claim the right to throw spears. Everyone knows that kings have that right. Everyone knows very, very well. How do they know? Because the king has told them so many, many times. Is it possible that this mad king was the true king, even the Lord's anointed? And what about your king? Is he the Lord's anointed? Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. No one can ever really know for sure. Men say they're sure, even certain, but they're not. They do not know. God knows, but he will not tell. If your king is truly the Lord's anointed, and if he also throws spears, then there are some things you can know and know for sure. Your king is quite mad. And he is a king after the order of Saul. God, chapter 5, has a university. It's a small school. Few enroll. Even fewer graduate. Very, very few indeed. God has this school because he does not have broken men and women. Instead, he has several other types of people. He has people who claim to have God's authority and don't. People who claim to be broken and aren't. And people who do have God's authority but who are mad and unbroken. And he has, regretfully, a great mixture of everything in between. All of these he has in abundance, but broken men and women, hardly at all. In God's sacred school of submission and brokenness, why are there so few students? Because all students in this school must suffer much pain. And as you might guess, it's often the unbroken ruler whom God sovereignly picks who metes out the pain. David was once a student in this school, and Saul was God's chosen way to crush David. As the king grew in madness, David grew in understanding. He knew that God had placed him in the king's palace under true authority. The authority of King Saul was true? Yes, God's chosen authority, chosen for David. Unbroken authority. Yes, but divine in ordination nonetheless. Yes, that is possible. David drew in his breath, placed himself under his mad king, and moved further down the path of his earthly hell. Chapter 6. David had a question. What do you do when someone throws a spear at you? Does it seem odd to you that David did not know the answer to this question? After all, everyone else in the world knows what to do when a spear is thrown at you. Why, you pick up the spear and throw it right back. When someone throws a spear at you, David, just wrench it out of the wall and throw it back. Everyone else does, you can be sure. And in performing this small feat of returning thrown spears, you will prove many things. You're courageous. You stand for the right. You boldly stand against the wrong. You're tough and can't be pushed around. You will not stand for injustice or unfair treatment. You are the defender of the faith, the keeper of the flame, the detector of all heresy. You will not be wronged. All of these attributes then combine to prove that you're also a candidate for kingship. Yes, perhaps you are the Lord's anointed. After the order of King Saul. There's also a possibility that some 20 years after your coronation, you'll be the most incredibly skilled spear thrower in all the realm, and also by then, quite mad. Chapter 7. Unlike anyone else in spear throwing history, David did not know what to do when a spear was thrown at him. He did not throw Saul's spears back at him, nor did he make any spears of his own and throw them. Something was different about David. All he did was dodge the spears. What can a man, especially a young man, do when the king decides to use him for target practice? What if a young man decides not to return the compliment? First of all, he must pretend he cannot see spears, even when they're coming straight at him. Second, he must learn to duck very quickly. Last, he must pretend nothing happened. You can easily tell when someone has been hit by a spear. He turns a deep shade of bitter. David never got hit. Gradually, he learned a very well-kept secret. He discovered three things that prevented him from ever being hit. One, never learn anything about the fashionable, easily mastered art of spear throwing. Two, stay out of the company of all spear throwers. And three, keep your mouth tightly closed. In this way, spears will never touch you, even when they pierce your heart. Chapter 8. My king is mad. At least I so perceive him. What can I do? First, recognize this immutable fact. You cannot tell, none of us can, who is the Lord's anointed and who is not. Some kings, whom all agree are after the order of King Saul, are really after the order of David. And others, whom all agree are after the order of David, really belong to the order of King Saul. Who is correct? Who can know? To whose voice do you listen? No man is wise enough ever to break that riddle. All we can do is walk around asking ourselves this question. Is this man the Lord's anointed? And if he is he after the order of King Saul? Memorize that question very well. You may have to ask it of yourself 10,000 times, especially if you're a citizen of the realm whose king just might be mad. Asking this question may not seem difficult, but it is, especially when you're crying very hard and dodging spears and being tempted to throw one back, and being encouraged by others to do just that. And all your rationality and sanity and logic and intelligence and common sense agree. But in the midst of your tears and your frustration, remember that you only know the question, not the answer. No one knows the answer except God, and He never tells. Chapter 9. I did not like that last chapter. It skirted the problem. I'm in David's situation. I'm in agony. What do I do when the kingdom I'm in is ruled by a spear-wielding king? Should I leave? If so, how? Just what does a person do in the middle of a spear-throwing contest? Well, if you didn't like the question found in the last chapter, you won't like the answer found in this one. The answer is, you get stabbed to death. But what is the good in being speared? You have your eyes on the wrong King Saul. As long as you look at your king, you'll blame him and him alone for your present hell. But be careful, for God has His eyes fashioned sharply on another King Saul. Not the visible one standing up there throwing spears at you. No, God is looking at another King Saul, one just as bad. Or worse, God is looking at the King Saul in you. In me, Saul is in your bloodstream, in the marrow of your bones. He makes up the very flesh and muscle of your heart. He is mixed into your soul. He inhabits the nuclei of your atoms. King Saul is one with you. You are King Saul. He breathes in the lungs and beats in the breast of all of us. There's only one way to get rid of him. He must be annihilated. You may not find this to be a compliment, but at least now you know why God puts you under someone who just might be King Saul. David the sheepherder would have grown up to become King Saul the Second, except that God cut away the Saul inside David's heart. That operation, by the way, took years. And was a brutalizing experience that almost killed the patient. And what were the scalpel and tongs God used to remove this inner Saul? God used the outer Saul. King Saul sought to destroy David, but his only success was that he became the instrument of God to put to death the Saul who roamed about in the caverns of David's own soul. Yes, David was virtually destroyed in the process, but this had to be. Otherwise, the Saul in him would have survived. David accepted this fate. He embraced the cruel circumstances. He lifted no hand nor offered resistance. He did not grandstand his piety. Silently, privately, he bore the crucible of humiliation. Because of this, he was deeply wounded. His whole inner being was mutilated. His personality was altered. When the gore was over, David was barely recognizable. You weren't satisfied with the question in the last chapter? You probably didn't like the answer in this one. None of us do, except God. Chapter 10. How does a person know when it's finally time to leave the Lord's anointed? Especially if the Lord's anointed is after the order of King Saul. David never made that decision. The Lord's anointed made it for him. The king's own decree settled the matter. Hunt him down, kill him like a dog. Only then did David leave. No, he fled. Even then, he never spoke a word or lifted a hand against Saul. And please note this. David did not split the kingdom when he made his departure. He did not take part of the population with him. He left alone. Alone. All alone. King Saul II never does that. He always takes those who insist on coming along. Yes, people do insist on going with you, don't they? They're willing to help you find or found the kingdom of King Saul II. Such men never dare leave alone. But David left alone. You see, the Lord's true anointed can leave alone. There's only one way to leave a kingdom. Alone. All alone. Chapter 11. Caves are not the ideal place for morale building. There's a certain sameness to them all, no matter how many you've lived in. Dark, wet, cold, stale. A cave becomes even worse when you're its sole inhabitant, and in the distance you can hear the dogs baying. But sometimes, when the dogs and the hunters were not near, the hunted sang. He started low, then lifted his voice and sang the song the little lamb had taught him. The cavern walls echoed each note just as the mountains had once done. The music rolled down into deep cavern darkness. It soon became an echoing choir singing back to him. He had less now than he had when he was a shepherd, for now he had no lyre, no son, not even the company of the sheep. The memories of the court had faded. David's greatest ambition now reached no higher than a shepherd's staff. Everything was being crushed out of him. He sang a great deal, and he matched each note with a tear. How strange, is it not, what suffering begets? There in those caves, drowned in the sorrow of his song and in the song of his sorrow, David became the greatest hymn writer and the greatest comforter of broken hearts this world shall ever know. Chapter 12. He ran through soggy fields and down slimy riverbeds. Sometimes the dogs came close, sometimes they even found him. But swift feet, rivers, and watery pits hid him. He took his food from the fields, dug roots from the roadside, slept in trees, hid in ditches, crawled through briars and mud. For days he ran, not daring to stop or eat. He drank the rain. Half naked, all filthy, on he walked, stumbled, crawled, and clawed. Caves were castles now. Pits were home. In times past, mothers had always told their children that if they did not behave, they would end up like the town drunk. No longer. Now they had a better, more frightening story. Be good or you'll end up like the giant killer. In Jerusalem, when teachers taught students to be submissive to the king and to honor the Lord's anointed, David was the parable. See, this is what God does to rebellious men. The young listener shuddered at the thought and somberly resolved never to have anything to do with rebellion. So it was then, so it is now, and so shall it ever be. Much later, David would reach a foreign land and a small, very small measure of safety. Here, too, he was feared, hated, lied about, and plotted against. He shook hands with murder on several occasions. These were David's darkest hours. We know them as his pre-king days. But he didn't. He may have assumed this was his lot forever. Suffering was giving birth. Humility was being born. By earthly measures, he was a shattered man. By heaven's measure, a broken one. Chapter 13. Others had to flee as the king's madness grew. First one, then three, then ten, and eventually hundreds. After long searching, some of these fugitives made contact with David. They had not seen him for a long time. The truth was that when they did see him, they didn't recognize him. He had changed. His personality, his disposition, his total being had been altered. He talked less. He loved God more. He sang differently. They'd never heard these songs before. Some were lovely beyond words, but some could freeze the blood in your veins. Those who found him and decided to be his fellow fugitives were a sorry, worthless lot. Thieves, liars, complainers, fault finders, rebellious men with rebellious hearts. They were blind with hate for the king and therefore for all authority figures. They would have been troublemakers in paradise if ever they could have gotten in. David did not lead them. He did not share their attitudes. Yet unsolicited, they began to follow him. He never spoke to them of authority. He never spoke of submission. But every one of them submitted. He laid down no rules. Legalism is not a word found in the vocabulary of fugitives. Nonetheless, they cleaned up their outward lives. Gradually, their inward lives began to change too. They didn't fear submission or authority. They didn't even think about the topic, much less discuss it. Then why did they follow him? They didn't, exactly. It was just that, well, he was David. That didn't need any explanation. And so, for the first time, true kingship had its nativity. Chapter 14. Why, David? Why? The place was another nameless cave. The men stirred about restlessly. Gradually and very uneasily, they began to settle in. All were as confused as Joab, who had finally voiced their questions. Joab wanted some answers now. David should have seemed embarrassed or at least defensive. He was neither. He was looking past Joab, like a man viewing another realm that only he could see. Joab walked directly in front of David, looked down on him, and began roaring his frustrations. Many times he almost speared you to death in his palace. I saw it with my own eyes. Finally, you ran away. Now for years, you've been nothing but a rabbit for him to chase. Furthermore, the whole world believes the lies he tells about you. He has come, the king himself, hunting every cave, pit, and hole on earth to find you and kill you like a dog. But tonight you had him at the end of his own spear, and you did nothing. Look at us, we're animals again. Less than an hour ago you could have freed us all. Yes, we could all be free right now, free. And Israel too, she would be free. Why, David, why did you not end these years of misery? There was a long silence. Men shifted again, uneasily. They were not accustomed to seeing David rebuked. Because, said David very slowly and with a gentleness that seemed to say, I heard what you asked, but not the way you ask it. Because once, long ago, he was not mad. He was young. He was great, great in the eyes of God and men. And it was God who made him king. God, not men. Joab blazed back, But now he's mad, and God is no longer with him, and David, he'll yet kill you. This time it was David's answer that blazed with fire. Better he kill me than I learn his ways. Better he kill me than I become as he is. I will not practice the ways that cause kings to go mad. I will not throw spears, nor will I allow hatred to grow in my heart. I will not avenge. I will not destroy the Lord's anointed. Not now, not ever. Joab could not handle such a senseless answer. He stormed out into the dark. That night, men went to bed on cold, wet stone and muttered about their leaders' distorted, masochistic view of relationships to kings, especially mad ones. Angels went to bed that night too and dreamed in the afterglow of that rare, rare day that God might yet be able to give his authority to a trustworthy vessel. Chapter 15. What kind of man was Saul? Who was this one who made himself David's enemy, anointed of God, deliverer of Israel, and yet remembered mostly for his madness? Forget the bad press. Forget the stinging reviews. Forget his reputation. Look at the facts. Saul was one of the greatest figures in human history. He was a farm boy, a country kid who made good. He was tall, good-looking, and well-liked. He was baptized into the Spirit of God. He also came from a good family. In his lineage were some of the greatest historical figures of all humanity. Abraham, Jacob, Moses, these were his ancestors. Do you remember the background? Abraham had founded a nation. Moses had set that nation free from slavery. Joshua gave those people a toehold in the land that God had promised them. The judges kept the whole thing from disintegrating into total chaos. And that's when Saul came along. It was Saul who took these people and welded them into a united kingdom. Saul united a people and founded a kingdom. Few men have ever done that. He created an army out of thin air. He won battles in the power of God, defeated the enemy again and again, as few men have ever done. Remember that. And remember that this man was immersed in the Spirit. Furthermore, he was a prophet. The Spirit came on him in power and authority. He did and said unprecedented things. And it was all by the power of the Spirit resting on him. He was everything people today are seeking to be. Empowered with the Holy Spirit, able to do the impossible for God. A leader, chosen by God, with power from God. Saul was given authority that is God's alone. He was God's anointed, and God treated him that way. He was also eaten with jealousy, filled with self-importance, and willing to live in spiritual darkness. Is there a moral in these contradictions? Yes. And it will splinter a lot of your concepts about power, about great men and women under God's anointing, and about God himself. Many pray for the power of God more every year. These prayers sound powerful, sincere, godly, without ulterior motive. Hidden under such prayer and fervor, however, are ambition, a craving for fame, the desire to be considered a spiritual giant. The person who prays such a prayer may not even know it, but dark motives and desires are in his heart, in your heart. Even as people pray these prayers, they're hollow inside. There's little internal spiritual growth. Prayer for power is quick in the short way, circumnavigating internal growth. There is a vast difference between the outward clothing of the Spirit's power and the inward filling of the Spirit's life. In the first, despite the power, the hidden man of the heart may remain unchanged. In the latter, that monster is dealt with. Interesting about God. He hears all those requests for power which fervent young men and women pray in every generation, and he answers them. Very often, he grants those requests for power, for authority. Sometimes, in answering them, he says yes to some very unworthy vessels. He gives unworthy people his power, even though there are piles of dead men's bones inside. Why does God do such a thing? The answer is both simple and shocking. He sometimes gives unworthy vessels greater portion of power so that others will eventually see the true state of internal nakedness within that individual. So think again when you hear the power merchant. Remember, God sometimes gives power to people for unseen reasons. A person can be living in the grossest of sin, and the outer gift will be working perfectly. The gifts of God, once given, cannot be recalled, even in the presence of sin. Furthermore, some people living just such lives are the Lord's anointed, in the Lord's eyes. Saul was living proof of this fact. The gifts cannot be revoked. Terrifying, isn't it? If you're young and have never seen such things, you may be certain that sometime in the next 40 years you will see highly gifted and very powerful men and women, reputed to be leaders in the kingdom of God, do some very dark and ugly deeds. What does this world need? Gifted men and women outwardly empowered are individuals who are broken, inwardly transformed. Keep in mind that some who have been given the very power of God have raised armies, defeated the enemy, brought forth mighty works of God, preached and prophesied with unparalleled power and eloquence, and thrown spears, and hated other people, and attacked others, and plotted to kill, and prophesied naked, and even consulted witches. Chapter 16. You still haven't answered my question. The man I sit under, I think he's a King Saul. How can I know with certainty? It was not given to us to know. And remember, even Sauls are often the Lord's anointed. You see, there are always people, everywhere, in every age, and in every group, who will stand and tell you, that man is after the order of King Saul. While another, just as sure, will rise to declare, no, he's the Lord's anointed, after the order of David. No one can really know which of the two is correct. And if you happen to be in the balcony, looking down at those men screaming at one another, you may wonder to which order they belong. Remember, your leader may be a David. That's impossible, is it? Most of us know at least two men in the lineage of David who have been damned and crucified by other men, by men who were absolutely certain that the ones they were crucifying were not David's. And if you don't know of two such cases, for sure you know of one. Men who go after the Sauls among us often crucify the Davids among us. Who then can know who is a David and who's a Saul? God knows, but he won't tell. Are you so certain your king is a Saul and not a David that you're willing to take the position of God and go to war against your Saul? If so, then thank God you did not live in the days of crucifixion. What then can you do? Very little, perhaps nothing. However, the passing of time and the behavior of your leader while that time passes reveals a great deal about your leader. And the passing of time and the way you react to that leader, be he a Saul or a David, reveals a great deal about you. Chapter 17. Two generations after the reign of Saul, a young man enthusiastically enrolled himself into the ranks of Israel's army under a new king, the grandson of David. He soon began hearing tales of David's mighty men of valor. He set out to discover if one of those mighty men might still be alive, and if so, to find him and talk to him, though he calculated that such a man would be over 100 years in age. At last, he discovered that sure enough, one such man still lived. Having learned of his whereabouts, a youth hastened to his dwelling. Anxiously, if not hesitantly, he knocked on the door. Slowly, it opened. And there stood a giant of a man, gray, no, white-haired, and wrinkled beyond expectation. "Are you, sir, one of David's mighty men of long ago, one of those men of whom we've heard so much?" For a long moment the old man surveyed the young man's face, his features, his uniform. Then, in an ancient but firm voice, he replied, never taking his steady gaze off the young man's face. If you're asking if I'm a former thief and cave dweller and one who followed a sobbing, hysterical fugitive, then yes, I was one of the mighty men of David. He straightened his shoulders with those last words. Nonetheless, his sentence ended in a chuckle. But sir, you make the great king sound like a weakling. Was he not the greatest of all rulers? He was no weakling, said the old man. Then sizing up the motivation for the young man's presence at his door, he replied wisely and softly, nor was he a great leader. Then what, good sir? For I've come to learn the ways of the great king and his mighty men. What was the greatness of David? I see you have the ambitions typical of youth, said the old warrior. I have the distinct notion you dream of leading men yourself one day. He paused, then continued reflectively. Yes, I'll tell you of the greatness of my king, but my words may surprise you. The old man's eyes filled with tears as he thought first of David and then the foolish new king only recently crowned. I will tell you of my king and his greatness. My king never threatened me as yours does. Your new king has begun his reign with laws, rules, regulations, and fear. The clearest memory I have of my king when we lived in the cave is that his life was a life of submission. Yes, David showed me submission, not authority. He taught me not the quick cure of rules and laws, but the art of patience. That is what changed my life. Legalism is nothing but a leader's way of avoiding suffering. Rules were invented by elders so they could get to bed early. Men who speak endlessly on authority only prove they have none. And kings who make speeches about submission only betray twin fears in their hearts. They're not certain they're really true leaders, sin of God, and they live in mortal fear of a rebellion. My king spoke not of submitting to him. He feared no rebellion because he did not mind if he was dethroned. David taught me losing, not winning, giving, not taking. He showed me that the leader, not the follower, is inconvenienced. David shielded us from suffering. He did not mete it out. He taught me that authority yields to rebellion, especially when that rebellion is nothing more dangerous than immaturity or perhaps stupidity. The old man was obviously remembering some very tense and perhaps humorous episodes in the caves. No, he said, now with a voice with a touch of eloquence, authority from God is not afraid of challengers, makes no defense, and cares not one whit if it must be dethroned. That was the greatness of the true king. The old man began to walk away. Both anger and regal patience were evident in his bearing as he turned. Then he faced the youth once more, thundering one last salvo. As far as David's having authority, men who don't have it talk about it all the time. Submit, submit, that's all you hear. David had authority, but I don't think that fact ever occurred to him. We were 600 no goods with a leader who cried a lot. That's all we were. Those were the last words the young soldier heard from the old warrior. Slipping back into the street, he wondered if he would ever again be happy serving under Rehoboam. One last chapter. Chapter 18. So, having come to the end of our study of Saul and David, do you feel greatly assisted? What's that? You're now certain the man you are under is not truly from God? Or if he is, he is at best only a Saul? My, how certain we mortals can be of things even angels do not know. May I ask you then what you plan to do with this newly acquired knowledge? Yes, I'm aware that you yourself are neither a Saul nor a David, but only a peasant of the realm. You do plan, though, to share your new discoveries with a few friends? I see. Then perhaps I should warn you that there is great danger with this heady new knowledge of yours. A strange mutation can take place within your own heart. You see, it is possible, but wait. What is it I see over there? There, in that distant mist behind you. Turn. Do you see? Who is that figure making his way through the fog? It seems I've surely seen him before. Look closely. Is it not possible for us to make out what he's doing? He appears to be bending over some ancient chest. Yes, he's opened it. Who is he? And what's he doing? He has taken something out of the chest. A cloak? It's some kind of cape. Why, he's putting it on. The thing fits him perfectly, falling about his shoulders.